Hi, and welcome to the Adland Podcast. I'm here today together with the founders of Will the Agency, Josh Denny, Head of Business Development, and Isaac Simpson, the Creative Director. Welcome, guys.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
That was Isaac. And Josh, where are you?
I'm good. I'm just sitting here at my place in Burbank.
Burbank. Nice. So you guys have opened an agency in Los Angeles, of all places, where the fire and red brimstone is burning right now. California seems to be burning down. Is it a good time to open an agency?
Is there any other time in California to open a business?
Yeah. If anything's going to save the world, it's going to be clever marketing, right?
Probably. So I saw that you actually came out on Twitter with a bang and got the attention of Kat Gordon and RGA and a bunch of other people, because you tweeted out a photograph of Hitler having a look at the Volkswagen, which he helped design and shape and actually name. I can't remember the tone or what you said about the tweet, but you were sharing the fact that Hitler actually was involved in the development of that car.
Right. Ultimately. So what we were doing there was when we launched, we were like, okay, what can we do for content just to kind of draw people to us and express ourselves as a brand? And, you know, since we are coming from a place of since we're outsiders and really trying to establish ourselves as sort of ad industry mavericks in a way, we were like, okay, what can we do about really dark facts from advertising history? So our favorite one and my favorite one ever is that Just Do It are the final words of a serial killer, who was Gary Gilmore, who was being executed. And he was like, just do it. And then, the people at Wieden Kennedy saw that and they pitched it to Nike. So
that's dark, man.
Yeah, I know. But I love that. I mean, I love that fact. It's just so fascinating. So we were kind of searching for other stuff, and we came across this amazing, slash terrifying picture of Hitler holding like an exact replica of the VW Bug. And we were like, wow, that's such an important icon from advertising history. It's interesting that Hitler was the guy who actually designed that, which was sort of fascinating to us. So we published that as sort of an interesting fact with, just from history. And of course, since people on Twitter have zero rationality at all, simply having a picture of Hitler on our feed made us into Nazis. And so when the sort of Twitter mob got angry because of the amazing article you published about us being anti-cancel culture, what they do is they come and start picking through every tweet you've ever made to find something to attack you with. So they were like, oh, picture of Hitler. You guys must be Nazis. And so that was how that happened.
Wow. First of all, I'm stunned that I saw the reactions to the Hitler tweet, and I was just like, why are people reacting this way? I mean, I'm sure everybody, or I thought everybody knew that George Lois used to say, we sold a Nazi car in a Jewish town by junking all the rules of advertising, which is how, which is how DDB actually became DDB and as well known as it is today. It is via the Volkswagen campaign. So, and to not know that Hitler designed that car when it was basically the first thing he was doing, I can't believe people have such poor knowledge of history.
Yeah.
I know that people don't have much knowledge of advertising history, which always bothers me, which is why I build a website full of advertising history. But I mean, how do you not know that Hitler built the Volkswagen?
I think one of the biggest problems is that, you know, people have these initial trigger reactions to, you know, even discussing topics. And you know, a lot of what Isaac wrote about in our initial sort of declaration piece on LinkedIn, and it was shared on all of our sites about why we founded the agency, was that, you know, we all, the thing that brought the three of us together and Brad Robinson, who's not with us here, is that we all believe that you have to be willing to turn over all of the rocks to find the best ideas. And so, you know, part of our process is in sort of evaluating where have some of the best and worst ideas come from. And we were kind of trying to share that process online. And it was obviously met with the exact kind of reaction that led to why we started this agency in the first place, is the idea that, you know, these so-called creative spaces, are not very creative, are not very inviting to, you know, different ideas or different processes to finding great ideas. And so we're guys that when we get in a room and we start brainstorming, like no one's ever going to get run out of the room for having a terrible idea or, you know, looking at something in the darkest or weirdest way to try to get to that great idea. And so we were trying to sort of peel back the layers a little bit and show that process. And it was sort of treated in a very Salem witch way, which is kind of what led us to, you know, starting Will in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are saying that cancel culture doesn't exist, which I find kind of funny right now, as most of Twitter are currently trying to cancel Netflix for the movie Cuties. So do you agree that cancel culture doesn't exist?
Well, no, obviously not. I mean, I think this is something that,
You have experience with it.
Well, yes. Josh and I both have personal experience with it, substantial personal experience with it. So I can tell you from a personal fact that it exists. I mean, you know, I think my favorite ad agency related cancel culture event of recent history is what happened to the CCO of Deutsch. I don't know if you're familiar with that, Brett Craig.
Mm-hmm.
No. So Brett Craig got fired from Deutsch for an offensive email that he wrote a long time ago. Essentially, the email was a casting email in which
where he was defining what he was casting for.
Exactly. And he said that he liked a certain person that was being casted because they were not too urban AA, which for those outside of the industry, what that means is that they weren't like too, you know, African American. AA stands for African American. And he was saying like they weren't too like gangster rap-ish, you know what I mean? I'm trying to find a way to say it in a non-offensive way myself. And but we all
Isaac,
know,
I love listening to you tap tiptoe around that, by the way.
I'm tiptoeing. So again, you know, this is I'll just be honest. Everyone in the ad world that I have seen on all sides, when you're casting somebody, you talk in that language. Talking about AA, talking about urban this, urban that. We all have said things like that when casting for a spot. And so somebody went
and casting agents in Hollywood talk like that too.
Right.
And usually the client starts it too, because they have like a little set list of what they need and central casting. And so you actually cast for the little rainbow that they want.
Exactly. And this guy, you know, was not trying to offend anybody. I don't think he was trying to be racist in any way. Like, yeah, he was making stereotypes and generalizations, but it was his job to make stereotypes and generalizations. And he got fired. You know, they dug up that email, and that was enough to have this guy's career wrecked. You know, and now he has the scarlet letter of a canceled racist. You know, and so to say that cancel culture isn't real, I don't understand how you could possibly think that. I mean, I think the counter a lot of times is, cancel culture isn't real. You're just saying that you think you should be able to say whatever you want and people shouldn't be able to respond, right? And so that is not what's happening, though. It's not that I think that people shouldn't be able to respond. People should be able to say whatever they want back. But responding with speech versus responding by destroying somebody's career, those are very different. It's a matter of degrees there.
I've worked on makeup and perfume, and I just have to say that the casting is far more dehumanizing in those areas, because, you know, you start sorting at people after like how they smile. So
right. I mean, imagine what women go through all the time being cast.
Yeah.
Anything. So many generalizations about who that woman is, and this is what we do when we're dividing our demos. It's all generalizations. That is literally what marketing strategy is. So to try and throw this guy under the bus for writing an email like that, and to for no one at Deutsch to come to his defense and say, okay, that's insane. I've written a million emails like that myself. That to me is just like, come on. Yeah, how can you say that cancel culture doesn't exist when you look at that case?
Yeah, and I feel like the one of the biggest pushbacks we got on Twitter was that there was no boss for anyone who hated us to report us to. You know, like, what are they going to do? Call Isaac and report me to him? Call me and report Isaac to me? I mean, I definitely feel like there was some anger towards the fact that people feel like, well, it's not fair that you guys just get to be yourselves at your company that you started. And it's like, yeah, that's part of the risk, you know, that comes along with the risk of starting a business is you get to operate it the way that you want. And so it's almost like, in a way, their outrage acknowledges the need and the desire for people to work for companies like ours. And we got, you know, as much as we publicly had people dragging us on Twitter, we are privately getting messages from the same companies, from employees saying, I wish I could come work for you. Please let me know when you're hiring, because it's terrible here that way. And everything that you're saying about the industry is true.
Yeah, no, I've noticed that there's a lot of same going on, not just in how the advertising companies are representing themselves on Twitter, but also in what's being produced by these advertising agencies. Like, there's at least 20 commercials running on TV right now with the line, you got this. I'm thinking this is like the end of the holding companies, because as they're bragging about having only millennials under 30 working for them, so that's great for the bottom line, it also means all the talent has left. And I'm seeing all the talent either going client size or starting their own agencies or making tons of money on freelance careers right now. I'm just wondering if this is the death of the big holding companies.
Well, you know, I just read a book called Frenemies. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's like a deep dive into sort of the way that the current modern advertising world really works. And so it deals a lot with Martin Sorrell just before his own canceling. So he's the, you know, founder of WPP.
Yeah, I call him Plastic Man.
Plastic Man, there you go. Why do you call him Plastic Man?
That's where he got his money. He worked in plastics.
Oh, did he? Oh, okay. Yeah, and he's a plastic man. I mean, you know, that's the idea of the traditional model, which has been completely taken over by these massive holding companies, dying is very popular. There's also another book by a guy named Michael Farmer called Madison Avenue Manslaughter. It's all about the same thing. It's hard for me to believe, though, that given our current economy, these massive, essentially, they're basically private equity groups, you know, that gut these agencies and just maximize profits while completely reducing anything of value. It's hard for me to believe that they're going to die. You know, like, I feel like they're such masters at market manipulation, and it's such a, for lack of a better word, circle jerk. You know, it's a bunch of rich guys basically paying the same massive amount of money back and forth to each other over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't really see, until there is a true stock market crash, I think the guys that are in control of the economy just have too much of a stranglehold on it. And you even see that with COVID, right? I mean, you see that with, while the ordinary common person is losing everything, it has almost no impact on the top, you know, whatever you would say, 1% or however much it is, the banker class. That has been almost entirely decoupled. And I think the advertising world is kind of the same way. It's like, those guys are living in a sort of totally separate world that is not really impacted. Like, I don't even think they really care that they don't have talent. Yeah.
Well, that would have really explained, like, how some people are spending tons and tons of money on producing advertising campaigns that are completely tone deaf and then completely fail in the general audience that they're trying to target.
I mean, right. Sorry, go ahead.
No. It's like there's a lot of campaigns that have had like a massive anti-reaction where people have really disliked the ads. Like Scandinavian Airlines was trying to sell Scandinavian Airlines to the rest of the world by claiming, you know, the old Viking heritage of flying around and then taking parts of other people's cultures. But the way the tone was written, it was as if there was nothing that was originally Scandinavian. and that upset everybody in Scandinavia.
What was it like?
It was just the tone itself was failing. I mean, the base idea is a good one, that Vikings travel and then they bring something back and they turn it into their thing. But basically the way the tone was done in the voiceover, it sort of sounded like there was literally nothing in Scandinavia that came from Scandinavia at all.
Oh,
essentially that the whole culture was stolen from other cultures
was how it ended up. And of course that's going to insult anybody from Scandinavia because, you know, we're patriots like everybody else.
Sounds like an idea that was originally pitched to U.S. Airways, most likely.
Well, that too. I mean, it's like, it is a more of an American idea to claim the melting pot than, you know, the Scandinavians taking everything from everywhere else.
Yeah. And you're seeing ads like that kind of all over the place where I think like brands, and Isaac wrote about this a little bit, is that brands are so focused on joining the current moment that they're not even stopping to think about whether or not their brand even connects with what's being said. You know, one of our big founding principles is making sure that we're the agency that helps brands join the right conversation. And when you see, you know, Lavazza Coffee taking, you know, that speech from the Great Dictator and plastering it over, you know, the crisis of our times, it's like, sure, it's a pretty ad and it's emotional and it gets a reaction and it's probably going to win awards, but I don't know that it's going to make me reach for Lavazza Coffee ever. You know, there's no connection to coffee whatsoever in that ad.
I've had a problem with that for years. There seems to be, like, if you look at all the causes in advertising and the fact that we have awards for causes, and now we have, like, you know, crystal glass awards for women, and we're going to have, like, whatever X awards for the left-handers. And it's advertising seems to be made straight for the awards. So you're going to have a cause, like, a couple of years ago, it was water, and now it's we have to, like, have diversity. And then a couple of years before that, it was women. And now there's ageism. So as long as the advertising is about the recent cause, it's going to win an award. And that's great for somebody's career, but it doesn't actually change anything.
Yeah, right. Is it ageism now?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen the new ageism ads. What are those?
There's a few big name people who are, like, ushered out of their ad agencies because they're getting too old, i.e. too expensive. And so that's the ageism thing that's going to get big now.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I'll keep
Yeah, you see some of this discussion. Prediction. You see some of this discussion on Fishbowl on how, you know, like you mentioned earlier, that agencies are like, we're all millennial. It's like, yeah, you thinned the herd, like, you basically office spaced your entire agency and got rid of everybody that was expensive and skilled and talented and experienced. And you're trying to present that as, you know, we're forward thinking. We're all millennials. It's like, no, you're inexpensive and cheap and running at a high profit margin. That doesn't mean you're going to have the best ideas.
I've never understood why advertising in general has always done this throughout my career, is brag about the people in their company that have no idea what they're doing. Like, they'll bring in like a guy, oh, this guy's popular because he's a street poet, so we're going to make him a copywriter. It's like, why?
right.
Well, it's funny because one of the comments on our Twitter threads of protest was like, I saw this one thread from, you know, I think it was from Kat, which you mentioned, from a group she's in or something. And one woman was like, apparently if you're a stand-up comedian, you don't even need a book. And I was like, well, I've been a stand-up comedian for almost 14 years. Nobody told me that. I would have went out and got one of these great design jobs for like 10 years ago if I knew I could just be a comedian. So it's kind of weird how, you know, the some of that stuff and at least the perception internally is that, you know, you can do almost everything but make great work and get paid to make great work.
It's funny about stand-up comedy. Luke Sullivan used to be a stand-up comedian, and he was saying that the stand-up comedians that made a career out of it, they were practicing every single night. And when he failed as a stand-up comedian, because he got booed off stage at one point, because he wasn't practicing, that's when he realized he needed to practice and practice and practice, and that's what he's doing as a copywriter. And his copywriting career was far better than his stand-up comedian career. So I think it's a point to be made here now that we're only hiring millennials that have never done anything.
Yeah. He wrote Hey Whipple Squeeze This, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I read that. That's cool. I think you're kind of capturing also on the trend of, so I went to the other day, like a Wieden Kennedy, like Zoom call to, you know, that was kind of like how to get a job at Wieden Kennedy with the people from Wieden Kennedy, you know, and of you zoom in and they're playing WAP, you know, the new Cardi B song, like blasting it. They're blasting it, and it's all you know, they're all in there talking about like what to do, how to get a job with a place like Wieden. And the thing that they say more than anything is, oh, you know, we don't care what you do 9 to 5, we care what you do 5 to 9, right? Mm-hmm. So now the whole idea is what they're trying to pretend is true is like, yeah, we, your creativity can come from anywhere, right? You can be, yeah, some sort of a down and out Venice street artist. And if you're cool, you can come work at Wieden, which is not true at all, by the way. You definitely have to work at the big agencies before you can work at one of these creative shops. And then beyond that, the sort of takeaway from that is that, okay, you're supposed to work at a big agency from, let's say, 9 a.m. till, you know, we all work till what, 7 p.m. And then you're supposed to go home and make clever side projects for the next 4 hours, then go to sleep and wake up and do it again. Right. So that's really what they're saying. They're saying like, yeah, we want like somebody who's just really passionate about creative in their free time, which actually means just do your work 24/7 every single day forever. You know?
Yeah, it means don't have children. That's what
it means. Don't have children. Yeah, totally.
Don't have a spouse that you will have children with.
Exactly. Don't have a spouse. Don't have a wife. Just love, you know, mark funny, clever, creative stuff that you can put on.
Yeah,
the
just that's how hustle 24/7.
Right. Exactly. Hustle 24/7. Connect yourself entirely to the machine all the time. You know, and I think that the reason why most work product has gotten so bad is because that's the type of people that are, you know, it's fruit of a poisonous tree, right? If the only people you hire are people who don't have lives, how do you market to people who do enjoy the little things of daily life, like having a family, like, you know, the simplicity of watching football on Sunday? You know, you're the people who are making the advertising are people who are driven only by success, right? And so those people really aren't like the common consumer of America or of any other country. So they don't really have much of a connection to those people.
True.
Yeah. And we we say that all the time in terms of, you know, cancel culture. And sort of what I experienced with a canceling as a comedian 2 years ago is, generally the people that are complaining or that can't relate or can't understand the bit, so to speak, are people that would have never been your customers in the first place. And so, you know, one of our pillars, we talk about, you know, we're great for your consumers because we are your consumers. To Isaac's point, if these people aren't actually ever wearing the hat of consumer and functioning on the consumer side of a brand, how could they possibly speak to those people in an educated way? And a big strength of being a stand-up comedian, and with particularly my background in large scale startups and some pretty big IPOs, has been in really being able to relate to your consumer and make decisions that benefit them, that work for them. And, you know, as a comedian, creating content that people can relate to and connect with. And if you don't have that ability to relate and connect, whether you're a creative, an artist, or anything like that, your work's going to fall pretty flat. No matter how woke the messaging may be.
Right. Your ability to read the room. Because like nobody seems to be reading the room anymore. There's ads that are coming out right now that are completely tone deaf. Like for a moment there when everybody was doing through the COVID, we all got sick of hearing the same piano and seeing the same Zoom things. And people discovered that all the ads looked exactly identical because everybody was in lockdown.
Well, I think that's a great, you know, one of the things I'll credit Isaac with is Isaac is very good at maybe one of his best strengths is that he's very good at immediately checking an idea and going, all right, how many other people or agencies are going to be thinking of this first thing? And then what's the next thing? Or what's the third thing that we can get to that's twice as creative, that's not going to be the place that everyone breaks down at? And when you saw the reaction to COVID, I was astounded. You know, being a guy that's kind of new to the ad world, I was astounded at how redundant the messaging was. It was just like, wow, all of these people make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to come up with the same first idea and run with it. It was, you know, very, very alarming to see the lack of creativity around that moment.
It was astounding. I mean, there were some of them were using the identical same lines.
Yeah.
In these uncertain times.
In these unprecedented times. It was like, could we not, please? And right. And it's to me, it's the same thing as you got this. Because if I hear that line again, I will personally drive out to that copywriter and slap them.
Everything is you got this now. That yeah, I could totally see that. You got this. Right.
It's just when I see the sea of same, it makes me sad, because as much as I actually disliked a bunch of ad in the 90s and the 2000s, because I can very much hate an ad and I can very much love an ad. At least I had like the range. There was the ones I hated and there was the ones I loved. And now it's a sea of same. I neither hate nor love any of it.
Sea of Same.
Yeah.
That's your book title right there. That's a great book title. Sea of Same. I love it.
Yeah. It would mean that I would sit down and write a book. Instead, I'm just filling this giant website with articles daily.
Well, and the wild thing that you mentioned too is like the lack of creativity from agents. The most creative ads and things that I've seen have really been internal from DTC brands that live on Instagram and live online. I was watching, I was just flipping through my Instagram feed yesterday and I came across I think it was like an underwear shipping company similar to like MeUndies. But they had I can't remember what their name was. Their name was like Corrupt or something like that. But the creative that they had in it was hilarious and funny and unique. And, you know, I'm sitting here going like, this is the kind of work that you're supposed to be able to hire an agency to do. And brands are starting to realize like the people that work for us internally, can get to these ideas faster, better, cheaper than us hiring an agency outside. And, you know, I think that's scary for those of us who, you know, especially for us who just started an agency, but that's the war, right? The war is proving that those great ideas can still live with agencies, and maybe they're smaller agencies or maybe they're newer agencies. But, I definitely think that's an uphill battle and something that small agencies like ours have to, you know, hold out work that proves that you can be creative and connect and actually drive performance, because at the end of the day, that's what it's about. If your ad doesn't drive revenue for the company you're making it for, it doesn't matter how many awards it wins.
Yeah, no, then it's just a wank.
A wank is right. So what are some of your favorite ads? I'm curious.
There's so many. there's just so many, but right now I can't think of anything right now. Although I did see a perfume ad on Instagram, which was a visual art director pun, so to speak. There was you just saw a man's torso and he had a denim shirt and a cowboy bucket like belt thing and denim jeans. And he was holding two finger guns salutes with his hands. And there was a third hand coming out of his jeans.
That's good.
So visually you just read kapow, kapow, kapow. And I was like, that must be a nicely scented perfume.
Yeah.
At least they sold the macho-ness of it quite nicely there.
Right. Totally.
It's difficult to describe visuals, but since I'm an art director, I get stuck on visuals a lot. I mean, one of the best ads that I refer to a lot is for The Guardian, Points of View from 1986. So it starts with a skinhead running after a man in a suit carrying a briefcase. So you're immediately thinking that the skinhead's going to rob the man. But then it's shot from a different angle, and you see that he's running there to push the man out of the way as bricks are falling from a building construction site above him. So he's saving the man. So it's only when you see the full picture that you can get all the points of view.
Oh, yeah. Then it's for The Guardian.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I love imagery like that. And I've always, you know, as a stand up and as an artist, you know, prior to my time in the ad world, I've always tried to do subversive stuff like that, you know, lead the audience down a path to where they believe that something is one way and then come to find out that it's another. And I think, you know, the reason that I feel like ads like that or creative work like that connects with people is because it kind of forces us to hold up a mirror and realize that some of the evil that we see in the world, it's just stuff that lives in our own minds. And it reminds us that a lot of the negativity is our own assumptions and our own things that we look at. And so I worry about advertising that just sort of finger wags and says, look how horrible the world is, and doesn't really take the opportunity to hold up mirror up to people and show them that, you know, part of fixing this, the responsibility of fixing this is also on you. It's not on Ford.
Yeah. Well, it's also, I mean, advertising better received if the viewer feels smart. So if you show them something and they have to come to a conclusion and they put pieces together in order to reach the conclusion, then they feel smart because now they've achieved something. But if you're actually just writing them on the nose, then right. I hate that. Everybody hates that.
Yeah, because it's too obvious.
It's refreshing to hear you say that people want to be acknowledged for being smart because, you know, from what I've heard from different, you know, ad people, not in our space, but, you know, outside of our space, their belief of their consumers. And this is kind of the Jim Gaffigan thing that I railed against last week is like, you know, it's very startling to hear people talk about what they actually think of their consumers and what they actually think of their customers, because you find out that they don't think very highly of them. They don't think they're intelligent. They don't think they're smart, or they think it's their job to feed them, you know, the garbage that that keeps them going. And, you know, I think that's kind of a startling awakening that people are starting to have, that like, hey, these brands don't necessarily think very highly of us in some cases. And the advertising speaks to that.
Yeah, no, that's been going on for a long time. I've worked in a lot of different countries. So I moved to Denmark to work there, and I had a creative director tell me immediately, well, you got to remember, they're not that bright in like the consumer space in Denmark. And then I moved to Holland and the Netherlands, and I worked there, and I had another creative director say the same exact thing. Yeah. You know, our consumers aren't that bright, and you keep expecting the consumers to be smart. So they keep asking me to dumb stuff down. But yeah. Then again, I was writing ads with like Kierkegaard and Ibsen in it, so maybe I was being a bit hyper.
Maybe leave the Kierkegaard, maybe leave the Hegel quotes out of that. The Hegelian philosophy.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, though? I think you guys are touching on something that is really kind of at the heart and soul, not just of marketing, but of our entire broken media system right now, which is that inevitably, you know, a large portion of the population is going to react to things emotionally instead of rationally. I think that that's always been the case. And the democratizing force of media makes it so that in order to sell anything, whether it's a political message or a product, emotions have to come into play. Because again, making a rational argument, yeah, sure, maybe that'll work on a small percentage, but the vast majority of people are deciding things based on their emotional reactions. So you can't blame, on the one hand, I think when somebody's saying something like, yeah, you know, they're not that bright, I don't necessarily think they're saying, I don't think it's as judgmental as it seems. I think what they're actually saying is, look, people inevitably aren't thinking that much about these ads, and we need to hit them where they live emotionally. And I agree with that, because it's inevitable. On the other hand,
That's a really good point. I was just going to say that because if you look at Twitter today, people are reacting immediately emotionally on things.
Yes.
And yeah. And I think that's probably the space that is the absolute worst for it. I went on some thread where I was explaining where the red triangle comes from. You know about the red triangle that Trump was tweeting out or something? So I was explaining the history of the symbol. Oh.
I have no idea. I haven't heard this at all. What's the red triangle?
The history of the symbol is that it was the workers' sort of union in Paris in the late 1800s. They wanted 8 hours of work, 8 hours of free time, and 8 hours of sleep. So they go out on May 1 with the red triangle, and this is really long time ago that they started doing that. They've replaced the red triangle now. They have flowers on the 1st of May, but that's where the red triangle comes from. So I went backwards in a thread explaining the red triangle and why you see it, like Antifa's using it today. And when the Nazis were putting people in prison camps, they had pink triangles for homosexuals and they had the red triangle for the communists. So this is where, you know, so it's been around, was my point. And I'm digging up all these examples. And somebody got very, very upset with me. And the irony was that he is French. So I would think that he would have known.
He would have known.
He didn't even wait to the end of my thread. Like, I go on really long threads sometimes, and he didn't even wait to the end of my thread where I was like, this is where it originated. So he was just like, good day, and, you know, basically blocking me. I think he's unblocked me now, but I found it really ironic that he didn't stop. He just got upset immediately. And I'm trying to teach the history of a symbol.
Right. Well, nothing's worse, the insult from a Frenchman, than good day. Good day, sir. yeah, no, I think...
I didn't even know he was French. He works in New York, so I had no idea. So.
Right. No, I think that's the struggle, right? And I think so many people on the more rational end of the spectrum, are so frustrated by, again, yeah, we faced it with, you know, when we posted that thing about Volkswagen, it didn't even cross my mind for a second that people would not be rational enough to understand that we were commenting on a dark fact about history. You know, I wasn't able to see it through their eyes of somebody who's just like, picture of Hitler equals endorsement of Hitler. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't even think about it that way. But to be good in our world, I think it's about accepting the fact that people are emotional. And instead of hating them for it, like loving them for it. I think that that's the disconnect here, right? I think that the people who are making this crap, as you're saying, that's the sea of same, right? I think the sea of same people have become so nihilistic that they're just like, all I can do is just keep hammering on these same emotional neurons forever. And they're disgusted with themselves at some core level that they've just stopped being creative. And as Josh is saying, they kind of hate their audience. And they hate them because they're emotional. Whereas what we're trying to do, and what I always struggle to do, is accept that the audience is emotional and try to find ways to connect with them anyway. And connect with them in a genuine way, not just a way of, I'm just going to plumb these emotional depths and just take whatever I can get out of here that is the most reliable thing of like, oh, you know, here is this same story we're hearing over and over again. I'm trying to find new stories to tell them that are more closer to the truth, or at least more closer to what I actually see in the world, and to not get so nihilistic about it.
Yeah, I mean, I find it really interesting that as the world is right now, there's a lot of like immediate emotional reactions on Twitter. Like Twitter is today is like what Facebook was 10 years ago. You basically hate everybody on it. And
yeah.
And Twitter 10 years ago was like, I want to hang out with all these people. It was like going to a pub and just saying hi to everybody. And but at the same time as we have that, we have people are listening to podcasts that have much more nuanced discussions, which that shows that they can actually pay attention and spend time. Whereas Twitter is like the micro attention. They can't do anything other than look at something for 2 seconds.
Right. Well, that is, I have been very encouraged by podcasts for that exact reason. You know, I mean, it's funny that we have this sort of myth of the short attention span when what are our two most popular types of media right now is podcasts and like ultra long form television where people are watching 10 hours of this like really elaborate story unfold over, you know, extreme amounts of time binge watching. So yeah, it's totally true. I think it's two extremes. You know, you have the no attention span, and then you have these really long attention span mediums that people are drawn to.
Yeah. And the art of the 30-second commercial has kind of vanished a little bit because everybody's doing 3-minute ones now.
Right. Yeah, true. Like 3-minute, like manifesto commercials. Right.
Yeah. They're all the sea is same. I can't stand it. I mean, there's too many manifestos. I did a manifesto generator on Adland few years back with the songs that you're supposed to have too. It was just, that took us an afternoon. It was just so easy to mock at that point.
Right. What songs is it?
Oh, God, it was like all of those indie twee things.
Oh, yes. Yes, totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Twee song. Fleet Foxes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Yeah. I think the hardest thing for, you know, and the hardest thing for me, you know, having the different sort of diverse background I have as both an artist and an entertainer, as well as a business person, is, you know, there's, you kind of come up through the corporate world, the business world, in leadership and executive management, understanding, like, you know, perception is reality, meaning that if your people perceive something about you, if you're going to be a good leader for them, you have to address it, whether you agree with it or not. We've gotten to a point in society where, you know, the creative side of me goes, well, that's true to an extent, but if people are willing to go to insane lengths to create a perception that is not based in reality at all, then I think you have to push back against that. And I think we're seeing that a little bit in response to some of the cancel culture stuff. And, you know, I'm a guy who very famously refuses to ever apologize for things that I do as a comedian, because, you know, the context is this is all done for the purposes of entertainment. None of this is serious. So to treat it so would be disingenuous. And so I think because those lines have blurred a lot, I think people, you know, in a very kind of cherry picking way, try to attribute meaning where there is none. And they try to claim there's no meaning when there definitely is. And so I think good advertising and good marketing kind of can help fix the barometer of that, which is clearly broken in our culture today.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is what's going to save us. You know, I mean, ultimately, the thing that has destroyed us is going to be the thing that's going to save us. It's fixing the message. And that's what we're trying to do.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think you're right. It's also, I find it really interesting because of the way that the channels have disintegrated now. I mean, it used to be in Sweden, it was very simple. We had like two channels, literally. And then the third channel appeared in 1986 or 87. And that's when we got commercials on TV. So the channels that we saw commercials on were either before the movies at the cinema or on channel 3, which is the first commercial channel that we had. So it was very easy to target people very specifically, like the people who watch Dallas. We're going to like just buy the block right here. And you can't do that anymore because there's like a bazillion channels everywhere. So now you have to find a different way of communicating with your clients because they could be anywhere.
Yeah. You know, I get a lot of questions personally about engagement marketing, because I've done a lot of that, and there's a lot of different words for that, but sort of clever ways to disrupt the news cycle and get a bunch of earned media and make waves. Because, yeah, you've gone from the polar extremes of what you're saying, where there's like several commercials in existence, and basically it's just like, you know, the targeting is so easy, and it's so easy to break through the barrier of attention to where it's virtually impossible to break through that barrier of attention now. And I think the best ads, the best campaigns are all things recently that cleverly find a way to exist within our information cycle and toy with it. Like they almost comment upon the information cycle as it is. And I think the most inspiring thing for me recently, or one of the most inspiring campaigns, has been what Ryan Reynolds did with the Peloton ad last year. Remember
yeah.
that?
Yep.
What did you think of that?
Well, it was very well timed, obviously. But I think also he has an advantage in the fact that he has so many fans on his own channel. Exactly. So he could boost it out there. It's very easy to start a snowball from that high up of a hill.
It's very true. And that's why it's very, very true. It's like they're very convenient that they had Ryan Reynolds to make that happen. And that Ryan Reynolds could call the actress and say, "Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds." And she's obviously going to sign up to do that, right?
Yeah.
So I hear you there. But the sentiment of it and the success of it is that you can make a, you know, what did it cost him to make that ad? 10 grand? You can make a 10 grand ad that will get so much more attention and do so much more for your brand and conversions than a $3 million commercial.
No, that's so true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's if you're looking at, for example, I was looking at the things that actually cut through most of the noise these days is what street artists are doing. So if advertising is more like street art, which is jumping in the right place to be seen in the right area to get as much PR as possible, then you're halfway there. And that's kind of what the Reynolds situation was too.
Yeah, yeah. Another one of my favorite kind of stunty things recently was, did you see the collaboration between Arizona Tea and Adidas?
Yes, I did. Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so for somebody who grew up, you know, going to sort of bodegas in Chicago, Arizona Tea was always 99 cents, even when I was a kid, the big can.
Yeah.
And so it's still 99 cents, which is amazing. They made a collaboration where they kind of did their Arizona Tea design on Adidas shoes and sold the shoes for 99 cents, which is, of course, a loss leader for them. They're not going to make any money on those shoes. But it was such a desirable product that it created a whole meme on the internet, and they had to like shut down the release of the shoes because there was such high demand for them, because it keyed into nostalgia and it keyed into people's love of sort of streetwear right now. And so in a way,
and we all have to admit that we love the look of that can. I mean,
yeah. Oh, I love it. No, it's right. It's, and on a shoe, there's something sort of like delicious about it on a shoe. Yeah. And, you know, so sometimes right now, products are actually, instead of marketing products, products are marketing, which is kind of an interesting thing that's happening. One of the things Will did actually in the very primordial stages was we made a collaboration generator. So like, you know, kind of a corn, like how everything is a collaboration now, you know, it's all just kind of cross pollination. I'll send that to you because I think, as somebody who creates generators, you'll appreciate it.
Yeah, there's a lot of co-branding going on. I think it's kind of fun because it shows a more playful side of brands, which I think we've been too serious with brands for too long, to be honest. I think advertising needs to find its sense of humor back. That was another thing I was going to say about on Twitter, because I noticed that there was a lot of advertising agencies that started engaging with you as an advertising agency. And I was just thinking about, as a client, if I was going to hire an advertising agency, I might, you know, Google their name, like, let's say RGA or something. And I would see their latest
just
tweet.
For a random example, RGA, hypothetically.
Yeah. And I might see their latest tweets. And I used to engage a lot with RGA because I don't know who's actually running that account, but they were quite sarcastic about advertising, and I thought it was fun to engage with it. But now that I'm looking at what comes up at the top tweets, like when you're searching in Google for RGA, it's never their work. And it's usually in jokes about advertising. And I'm thinking, if I was a client, I probably wouldn't want to hire them because I'd be wondering how much of the money I'm paying them goes to them snarking on Twitter.
Right. How many client hours are being billed?
We did kind of call that out. We did kind of call that out, which was interesting. That was in a way how we got their attention, was that there was a bit of a back and forth, and then, you know, that we essentially said, boy, I wonder which very expensive client bill is being sent out today for you to spend time bantering with us on Twitter. And then their response was, you know, well, we could say the same about you guys. And I go, yeah, but two tweets ago you said we don't have any clients, so which is it? You know, like, do we not have clients, or are we wasting their money? Because I can guarantee you that one of us is definitely wasting their clients' money today.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't actually engage with anybody with Adland anymore because it has too many followers. And if I write an article, there might be 100 comments on it on Twitter, and I don't engage with that at all because there's just I don't have time to do that. I won't be able to write any more articles if I have to respond to people on Twitter. So I have my own personal Twitter account where I chat as much as I want to, but the brand account doesn't engage with people.
Yeah, and one of the, we kind of experienced a little bit of that too, and I think we went through a bit of an organic course correct, Isaac and myself, because, you know, myself being essentially a professional shit talker for so many years, my first reaction is like, wait a minute, you guys don't do this better than me. I know I do this better than you, so let me quickly establish that you're in the wrong ring. And then we very quickly realized, like, this is not the battlefield for that, you know, and to your point, we don't want to be an agency whose clients Google us and then see that we're bantering back and forth and looking just as bad as some of these multi-million dollar agencies. And so I think, you know, going forward, we're more focused on putting out messaging and content that kind of helps identify who we are and shapes who we are. And we'll just let people kind of talk about that however they want to, whether they're wrong or not.
Mm.
Yeah. Also, sassy brand Twitter has got to be one of the most irritating things.
Yeah, I was gonna say, there's been so many brands on Twitter that have Burger King, Wendy's, and whatever, they do the sassy brand thing. And for a moment there, that was a way to cut through Twitter clutter. But now I just find it tedious.
It's tough, right? Because, Popeyes made their so much money on a single tweet of sort of mocking a Chick-fil-A reaction to their sandwich announcement. So they tweeted in sassy brand Twitter lingo. They tweeted a Chick-fil-A. So Popeyes released their sandwich. On the same day, Chick-fil-A made a post sort of saying, get the original best chicken sandwich here, right? They didn't mention Popeyes. But then Popeyes, their sassy tweeter, tweeted at Chick-fil-A, y'all good? trying to kind of say, are you doing okay? It seems like you're butthurt about the fact that our new chicken sandwich is out. And it exploded. It blew up because I think it was just funny. People really liked it. It appealed to the Popeyes audience. And it probably supercharged the sales of that chicken sandwich by many, many times. So it does kind of work. You can't totally hate sassy brand Twitter. Also, there's the whole steak. What's the Steakums thing? Have you seen that?
Well, that's more existentialist, right?
Yeah. Well, the Steakums, I don't quite. Everybody was loving it for the longest time, but it's at some point I just want a sauce or a sandwich. And I don't really need to hear what they learned in their first year of university, studying socioeconomic politics or something. And it's I studied at uni. I've lectured at uni, so I might know a little bit more about that.
That might be the place to land your Kierkegaard stuff is with the Steakum people. Yeah.
I'm going to have to tell you what the ad was now. It was actually for beer, and there were street fights between the gangs of the Kierkegaard copies supporters and the Ibsen supporters. And they would argue in only good. In quotes from Kierkegaard and Ibsen.
I love that. That would definitely make me buy the beer, but I'm probably, 0.1% of the population who would enjoy that.
You're a bit of a literary highbrow in that regard.
I'm literally reading Schopenhauer. I'm reading Schopenhauer right now.
Well, see, it's because it was the tagline for the beer was our beer, and so in the end you would just zoom back into a bar and there would be a guy just watching these idiots fighting outside, and he would just take a sip of the beer. So the our beer is for the people who are different. Who are not falling into the gangs. That was kind of the whole point of that. So instead of doing, mods versus rockers, I did Kierkegaard versus Ibsen.
and then the beer. So you're not even choosing sides. This is about staying out of the fray of the philosophical.
This is about being independent and having your beer. Yeah.
Well, so in the future, what that ad will be is it'll be 20 versions of that ad, right? And each one will have two different teams. So, and it'll be hyper targeted. So there'll be your ad, which will be Ibsen versus Kierkegaard, and it'll be targeted to people who like philosophy on Facebook. But then there'll be 20 other versions, and one will be rap music, and it'll be Biggie versus Tupac, and then one will be,
You just summed up exactly how to use the many, many channels now. You're gonna have to get a client that wants to brand itself all over the internet, so you can target very specifically.
Exactly, and then so you weren't off actually. You were on the right track. You just needed to make 20 other versions with different sort of specific interests in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we're actually running through Collab Generator right now. I'm really looking forward to our All-State NWA mashup ad.
right.
This is excellent. I mean, that's one of the things that I always expected that the internet would give us. It would give us better targeting so that we could actually find the people who the ad isn't just, a noisy interruption, but information for them. This is the thing you were looking for. And we don't have that. And it's partially because, privacy issues. So even if we can target and retarget, we're basically stalking them with banner ads of products they already bought. And another reason is because of the way that ads are sort of shotgunned out all over the web, that you suddenly end up on a YouTube video with a topic that you really don't want your ad associated with. So people are pulling back on advertising on the internet. And then, and there's also, I mean, there's groups that are helping that, like the groups who are pressuring people to take ads off of Breitbart and take ads off of Fox News and take ads off of whatever, I can't remember, Sleeping Giant or whatever they're called. So now they're discovering that news you have to pay for. And so that means that the people who can't afford to have subscriptions to the New York Times aren't getting the same news. Because the free news is basically clickbait.
And the people will end up paying like huge premiums for good news. I already am one of those people. I pay for the Wall Street Journal every month and it's like $40. And I think that, you know, they're able to do that because, you know, they're the one news source that still has the lights on without selling tons of native advertising.
Yeah, like most of the places that are free, they have like so many articles that are pretending to be articles that are actually just ads as well, which I think is kind of disturbing. But I've just seen it recently. It was, they tried to get the Spectator in the UK to, the Co-op was on it, and somebody's told Co-op to remove their ads from them. And then the Co-op apologized for having advertised on them. And then the Spectator UK said, we have like a huge silo between the advertising and the editorial. So you're disinvited from ever advertising with us again, because you should have no sway over the editorial content. And I think it's important for papers to establish this silo again, because this siloing system used to exist. And during clickbaity time, it doesn't exist anymore. So when people are pressuring to remove ads from certain places, they are strangling the only income.
Journalism.
Yeah, they're strangling journalism. They're strangling information.
Right. And that's the whole programmatic blacklisting question, you know, where it's, I don't want my ad to show up next to the word Trump or the word ISIS, right? So it's such a warped incentive program, because now every single journalism organization is incentivized to just crank out endless fluff, because that's the only thing people will pay to advertise next to. I mean, again, ultimately somebody's just gonna have to, we're being kind of destroyed by the First Amendment in a way. We're being destroyed by both the First and the Second Amendment in America. And you know, I love both of those amendments. I love the Bill of Rights. As an American, I truly believe in them, but we sure are paying a big price for them, because it prevents us from, you know, the things that we don't have any checks and balances for, at least in this country, is the media, right? So arguably the most powerful force in common life has no guardrails. They can do and say whatever they want. They can sell you the most, you know, infuriating, toxic crap all day long. And zero hard journalism, because there's nothing in place to stop them.
Yeah, advertising is actually far further regulated than journalism.
Than media, yeah.
Yeah, we are not allowed to lie, for example.
Exactly, right. That's a great point. I hadn't thought of it. That's a very good point.
Well, in a way, don't you find that's an advantage for advertising, in the sense that at least there are some parameters built in that should help you build sort of that sense of, and I'll use this word, I know Isaac hates it, but that sense of authenticity. And I think brands and companies, you know, I think everyone knows, and this is kind of what I see in the sort of the entertainment spaces, everybody knows that authenticity is important. But it's like they're so used to manufacturing the execution of things that they're like, oh, we need to be more authentic. Well, how do we do that? It's like, instead of just sort of getting to the core of what people love about a brand or a product and finding a way to tell that story. And, you know, for me, I associate all these things with storytelling. And I think if the story is there around a brand or a product, and you can tell it in a way that's authentic, I think it will resonate with people. I also think a lot of people are just kind of tired of their brands, companies, and products wearing hats that don't fit. And so, you know, and especially when they're used to seeing that in their news, they're seeing things in their news. And, you know, what's interesting is I'll watch a lot of these sort of man on the street pieces with different like YouTube personalities, and they'll interview people that are at a rally or a protest. And my takeaway is like, these people are actually very, very intelligent. The problem is that they've been so indoctrinated with the things that they've just been hammered with through the mainstream media and the mainstream news that it's like their world is kind of shaped by those things, and their intelligence has to kind of permeate through the bullshit. And, you know, and I think they've gotten so used to just dealing with that, that that's why some of those sort of marketing campaigns that miss entirely are perceived as successful when they're really not. And I think, you know, it just because people have this sort of default reaction to kind of accept the, sort of the mainstream media's narrative, I think almost everybody is on the next level of consciousness questioning those things, you know, and knowing that that this is a rotten thing and it's not been right for a long time and it's not to be trusted. And so I think they're learning through that. And I think people are starting to look for new places, and podcasting is a great example, where they can get something that's a little bit more authentic, a little bit more true, and a little bit more real. And we're hoping to be an agency that's on the forefront of creating work that is starting to push things back in that direction of getting back to what is real and authentic and true about this thing. And then those things should also make it cool. And then that should be the conversation.
Yeah. Well, it does open up for different channels where you can advertise, because if the audience is walking away from the instant and the Instagrams and the TikToks. I mean, I don't understand why the Wall Street Journal has a TikTok. And there's why is he even there? Oh, well, you got to, like, you know, create content in all the channels. And it's like, yeah, but it's there's a dude doing funny things in his apartment as their TikTok. What does that have to do with the Wall Street Journal?
Why is there the pressure there to, for everyone to have a social, you know? And do you think that'll go away?
I certainly hope so. I don't think it's appropriate for news producers to be in places where news is not consumed, unless, you know, it would be different if they came out with short headline things, because they are producers of news. Why don't they do that there? But they're like, no, we're gonna do TikTok the way TikTok is done, and that's funny dances to music. And it's like,
right,
that's not your thing. Like, maybe don't do that.
There is a weird desperation with some of those new social channels. And I've always been a late adopter for that reason, because I'm like, if this doesn't make sense for me to do it, I'm not going to jump on it. And I've even had times where, like, I've tweeted commenting about TikTok content and people are like, you're 37, dude. You're not even allowed to be on there. And it's like, I agree. It's why I don't have a TikTok channel. It's why you're never going to see TikTok stuff from me. But yeah, it's amazing to me that brands don't have that same sense of self-awareness. Like, if you're the Wall Street Journal, what are you doing on TikTok?
Yeah, no, honestly. And to me, it's kind of funny too, speaking of the canceling of Netflix. Now everybody's quite upset with the movie Cuties, which is long form content. I agree with being upset about it, because I have seen and read enough about this movie to actually not like it. But if you look at TikTok, you have 11-year-old girls doing the same dance moves there, but, you know, nobody's complaining about that.
Right. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on Cuties? I hate even looking at the pictures at all. So I can't, like, click on any of the stories because I don't want to see the pictures.
Oh, I can understand where the director came from and the story she wants to tell. It's just, I find it really inappropriate that she's using 10 and 11-year-old actresses to do this. And if her point, and she says her point, is that, the young girl is trying to, like, move out of the religious household she's from, and it's adventurous for her to go to this French dance group thing instead. And she's breaking free from the stifling tradition. Yes, it is. And then, so they're doing this dance performance on a stage. We're lingering too long on the young women. The point is that the women who in the audience who see it start booing. You could do that without showing the young girls dancing.
Right.
So, okay, so that's, I think she failed as a director. If that was the point she was going to make, she failed as a director. And also, she's on a TikTok together with the girls, and she was using that makeup meme. And I don't think it's appropriate that 10-year-old girls are doing the makeup meme.
Right.
I don't know if you know the meme, but it's like, you start without makeup and then you glam up and then you pass the makeup brush to somebody else.
Yeah. Well, okay. In a way, it's kind of funny, because, you know, as much as, like, as much as people want to bastardize, you know, artists for using children in their art, I'm always taken back to that scene in Bruno, the Sacha Baron Cohen movie, where he's literally casting babies for these horrendous reenactments of like horrific historical moments. And he's talking to the, like the Hollywood parents, and he's like, listen, we thought we would put the baby in a pile of Nazis and the Nazis would be saluting him like a baby Hitler. Are you fine with that? And they're like, oh yeah, whatever it takes. Like he could play a great Hitler. And it's like a, it's like a 1 year old baby. And so in some way I go, listen, like it's fair game. These children all had parents who signed off on this, who probably read the script and everything else. So you know, one of the areas where like, I'm sort of a free speech, you know, purist in the sense of like, even if it's offensive, even if it's inappropriate, if it's done in the name of art, those people have to have the right to bomb, the right to miss. Like that director has the right to make a shitty movie. And if it's a shitty movie that doesn't connect, that people hate, they're allowed to do that. And that's just, that's part of the price that we pay with having free speech. It's just, you know, you got to take the bad ideas with the good. That's how you get to good ideas. And the thing that really bothers me a little bit now that I'm seeing from people on the conservative side is they have this mentality of, well, we'll just play by the same rules of the insane people on the left that want to cancel everything and censor everything. And it's like, that's not how we fix it. That is not how we fix this problem.
Yeah. No, it's that just ends up with a like an escalating turf war on the different sides. And
well, an art and creativity will not be best served by a race to morality. You know, that is not the way we're going to get great creative ideas or great film ever again. If you look at every film, I bet you could go back and look at The Godfather under today. And there's a really funny, if you go follow the comedian Kyle Dunnigan on Instagram, he does this sort of mock podcast called Pussies. And it's just two very woke feministy men reviewing movies and their toxicity. And they just, him and Kurt Metzger just put one up where they review Star Wars and talk about how toxic and awful it is. I mean, the funny thing is like they're parodying this kind of thing in our culture that exists, but it's not different from the real way that people try to look back at art now historically and say, look how problematic The Godfather was for Italian Americans and the perception of it's like, listen, man, you can go back and try to apply new moral code to so much art that's existed since the beginning of the time, but it's like, no, we're not running in and covering David with a towel. You know what I mean? And so these are the kind of things that like, you know, it's a slippery slope when it comes to censoring art and limiting creativity. And I think society is going to be a much darker place the more we seek to control art and creative things.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's also, I see that it's hypocritical in so many ways.
Sure, it definitely is.
So, Josh, you're saying you're okay with pedophilia. That's what you're saying.
Right. Well, I mean,
that's the tactic that people will throw at you. It's like, again, if you tweet a picture of Hitler, you love Hitler. And it's like, no, this was a WTF Hitler post. And they're going, no, it's not. You know what it is.
Right. Yeah, well, that is the thing. I mean, everybody's hating on the cuties, but everybody is fine with TikTok existing. And it's like, well, that's where this hypersexualization of young girls is happening. So how can you be fine with that? I mean, the movie is at least a comment on it in a social way. Like, this is what it's like to be an immigrant from a really strict religious upbringing in France, where kids are hypersexualized.
Sure. And this idea that you have to agree with what art tells you, it's like, I think some of the best art that offends you, it forces a conversation. And so it's sort of like the idea of like, you don't have to agree with the point the director is making, but you have to defend their right to try to make that point and start a conversation from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just my opinion. You know, I'm very much, you know, and by the way, you can look at my record. To my own detriment, a 100% free speech purist of like, I don't care how bad people's ideas are, that they have to be allowed to have them. And I truly believe that's how we get to the best ideas as a society. Is you got to let people think terrible, shitty things and make them, you know, test those ideas against better ideas, and the better ideas will win. But when you sort of stifle an idea or you sort of push it underground, then sometimes it can build credibility it doesn't deserve on its merits. And that's where you get radicalization.
Yeah. And it's also, that's how you get really bad ideas growing. Because that's I think, how the sea of same happens at agencies. Because nobody wants to build on the shitty ideas. Nobody wants to say anything different than that stupid blandness that was first presented, and they don't build on it, and you don't get anything better.
The perfect example of this is
You got it.
You got this. The perfect example of this right now in our culture is Flat Earth conspiracy. When it started to gain weight or gain a little momentum like 4 or 5 years ago, people's response to it was, the idea that the Earth is flat is so absurd, we won't even discuss it. We won't even debate it. And guys like Neil deGrasse Tyson were like, I won't even engage in debate about it. And then what happened? It went underground and it gained momentum. And now there are people that are hell-bent on believing that the Earth is flat, no matter how many goddamn high-def cameras Elon Musk launches into space today, they'll still believe that it's all part of a government conspiracy. And that comes from... It comes from two facts that they know to be true. One, the media and the government lies to us. And two, this is something that we've just assumed is true and nobody's willing to have a scientific discussion about it. So those are the two recipes for conspiracy. And then that's why a movement, and anytime you have a conversation with these people, you go, so if the Earth is flat, explain gravity. And they'll immediately fall apart in the middle of the conversation. But the amazing thing is like those movements grow because they're shunned and not allowed, or they're not forced to be tested on their merits. And so we dismiss them, and it gains traction and it gains movement. And those are the same thing with like hate groups, right? Like groups that really believe in, you know, supremacy or eugenics or things like that. It's like, force those people to test those shitty ideas against better ideas, and those ideas will go away. When you force them underground, you only lend credibility to their merit, and that's how they grow, and that's how sort of terrible ideas and shitty worldviews are allowed to continue to live, is that when you censor it and say you're not even allowed to talk about that or force it to be tested.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can prove that the Earth is not flat. Because I have cats, and if the Earth was flat, they would have pushed everything off the edge by now. Yeah, I want to thank you so much for coming to the podcast. We've spoken for like an hour now. So thanks very much for coming in. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. This was great. I love nerding out on advertising anytime, so thank you. Shape up, turn up, turn up with Debbie.